Fashion number 14982, Mr. J. Brown, reel 12.
Going back to living conditions in the box, were you getting any additional supplies? Was anyone like the Salvation Army or people like that coming through to you?
No, not at that time. No concert parties. No. we got absolutely nothing at that time. But basic rations, and most of them were dehydrated, which over a too long a period of time, you would have this, that, and the other. And we were getting tablets instead of greens, you know. They were doing the best, but I suppose. And anyway, when Rommel moved down, sending probes out one thing or another, he found it was going to be too difficult to get through us. So what he did, he left a skeleton line to keep us there, Italians and German strong points in between, you know, with a bit of armour and that. And he went round our flank, right round, and built up to go through the 151 Brigade, the 150 Brigade into Tobruk, which he managed to do like. But in the meantime, we were sending out columns to harass them, you know what I mean. And
Did you get involved in this?
Went up one or two, why? It was just as covering fire and such as that, you know.
What was happening?
Well, all they did, they went out, and he was traveling there at night as well, mind, but they used to get out there, wait for dawn. You know, and he wouldn't be coming down in an army at a time, you know. He'd be coming down with supply columns and such as that. We had to watch for tanks, like, if the tanks were them, you were out of luck. And see them coming down, carriers would rush out, a couple of carriers, fire a few bursts and such as that, you know, panic station. Some tried to run for it and some didn't. But after that, you find you collected a hell of a bag of prisoners. I was surprised how many prisoners they got, like. And being out one particular one, he's there. We're a kind of few prisoners, and the trucks, it was Italians, by the way, the trucks had jerry cans full of water on the back. Well, we supplemented our lot with that, you know. And there was even, orange juice, you know, mineral waters. There was a couple of them, like, so we didn't do so bad, like. And we had an outpost which they operated from about 3-4 miles in front of our main line. Those dummy minefields, you know. Couldn't stop anybody, but he used to keep a troop of artillery there, and there was a company out there at the time, or a couple of platoons, you know. There was about four armoured cars. They were operated by South Africans, and it's supplementary arms and such as that. And he used to operate from there, these columns. He was having a great time. And then he realised what was happening. He started to try and close the gaps, you know. And we were back in the box this day. You never got a minute to peace. If you went out there with one of the rifle companies, you know, you had someone else to do. Right. Get out with a 1500 weight. There's been a German Messerschmitt 110, you know, the two-engine fighter bombers, like. Been hit by an anti-aircraft coming back over our box. He was down maybe about a mile and a half out. His armoured cars went out. Plane was destroyed, obviously, and they brought the crew back. And one he'd been hit in the stomach with shrapnel, he was in the pool there. And the other one, he was about 6 foot bloody four, and he was a typical Nazi, you know. So when I'd bring this couple of prisoners, bring them back, went out. I forget where he was in charge of the box. I said, get them on there. He said, that man's badly hurt, mine. So I went, oh, he was moaning and groaning. He was shouting for water, you know, vasa, vasa. Well, the worst thing you can give a bloke with stomach wound is liquid. Didn't give him liquid. He gets on the 1500 weight. His mate was sitting at the back, and there was a lad driving, there's me and another one, and he was a vasa. And his mate was playing early. He wanted vasa, vasa. He said, nine vasa. Nine man crank, you know. So a lad from Manchester drew, he said, I'm sick of him. He said, I'll blow him off the back of the wagon. We'll tell him he's trying to escape. I said, no, I said, intelligence officer might try and get someone out of them, like. But anyway, I went far from the box, you know, and I said, all right, we didn't have water. I give him a drink of water. Just got him back in, just got through the minefield, got reported in, and the medical place was about as deep as this, half as big again. It had been really dug out, was whitewashed out and everything, went down steps and all that. Got him down there and he died, like, aye. So I went up and I tell him, I said, I don't know if you're saying, I said, you murdered your friend. Finished, crank. He's looking. Passer, Nick's Vassar. But he was just looking at me. Because Tommy Burnett was there, little fat pot bellied, you know, from our Simon. Come on, punt, he said, get yourself out. That's it. Sympathetic, you know. But another day we come back, what was it? We went out there. Went out there early in the morning, just for a bit of support. Midday. Note had happened, and forget the bloody officer, we get chained every day. Right, you go back to the box, corporal. I says, right, oh, I went back. Halfway back, and there was 12-hour ambulances in the distance coming, drifting, you know. 12-hour ambulances, you know, I can tell the different shape. The only thing on the above on the top of the cab was the swastika flags. Oh, they'd been captured, obviously, you know. So I did a right hand down. And away after them. They turned, they high tailing it, but they dropped down. Of course, that time, the Bren guns, we had a, there's a lot of people not believe me about this, we had a 100-round magazine on. You put your money on it, like. I mean, everybody said a 30-round magazine, but they were come with some mine, but for anti-aircraft work and such as that, you know, 100-round magazine, you had a special plate, slipped on the breech box, clipped on, you put this 100-round magazine out like a bag of coal, you know, and you could, within range, you could keep going, but the rate of fire, it was warping the barrels, you know, in the heat. But anyway, we had a 100-round magazine on, she kept going, we went to diamond, like, so a fire burst over the top, you know. They seen the trace and they dropped anchor. There's 10 of them jumped out, you know, minus the arms, like, left arms here, and they were running around, this, that, and the other, and this, that, and the other, so just put a burst in front of the feet, and they all got together. I mean, I didn't know the British didn't do that, like. If it's there, like, that's it, but they were bloody terrified. So I got the drivers sorted out.
Were these Germans or Italians?
Germans. Oh, Germans, aye, in Africa Corps. And they wanted to give us cigarettes, wanted to give us that, you know. But we're in the back getting the water out, that's it. Sniff the cigarettes. And we sort the tow drivers out anyway and put them back in. Put a lad in with him, and me and the driver just followed them back to the box, like. So we won two of our ambulances back.
Who was commanding the battalion now? Had there been any changes?
Jim Beard. Beard still had it, but just before the real big push come, Beard left us. He got promoted. He got brigadier. He went to an Indian, or no, a West African brigade or something like that, or an Indian brigade. And we got, I thought, oh no, my friend McLaren, he'd been picked up. Shouldn't say it like this, he was brave enough soldier, like. He took a column out, all D Company, this rent was starting to heat up, you know. He took D Company out, called it Ross Column, called him Ross McLaren, like. They run right into a bloody trap, and they got well beaten up and lost, you know. And there wasn't very many got back out of D Company. But he'd walk right into a bloody trap. I don't know why he didn't have scouts out, or his horse have a carrier out, or a 1500 weight away ahead. If they get knocked off, we're in all this trouble. And he got took prisoner there. So we, Beard left us, and we got Jake Jackson, Stonewall Jackson from the Green Howards. He's a terrible area, big tasher on a bloody wild man. They're all right. Well, except for Beard, they're all wild men, I think. And he took over. Why, 2 o'clock in the bloody morning, blacked out. He decided he wanted to go out the outpost. Get the job, 1500 weight escort, you know, and this, that, and the other. Stunk to high heavens of whiskey. And one thing or another, and off you'd go. Dead of night. Do you know where you're going? They was asking us. We've been out every day. Bloody weeks and weeks. They're going to say, do you know where you're going? And he got in this night. Drew was driving again. He's unbelievable. He's fiddling now with his pistol in there. He pulled a bloody trigger. and a round one, so the floorboard just passed the foot brake. It must have just missed. Drew says, you know what you're fucking doing, man? He said, they shot my foot off. I got a bloody kind. Might as well. They just say, oh, you know. Well, I said, oh, my God. Couldn't happen in normal circumstances. he never carried on from there. And Drew was nobody. He said, do you ever meet any bugger like that? You know, this is going off. And I said, shut your bloody mouth, man. He'll get us both locked up. Hey.
But how did you navigate in the desert?
Why, from the box to the outpost was no problem, because it was a well-worn track, you understand what I mean, like. But in daylight, in daytime, they used battles, they were painted battles and such as that, you know, they won advantage points, you know what I mean, this, that and the other. And by all accounts, it was in charge of the intelligence office, if you're on the move, was there, you know, they reckon they could stay by stars at night, like. I suppose you can do that, you train, sort of, where the sun's lying. It's just, but it's mostly barrels, mind, you know. There'd be empty, there's tons empty, them big 40-gallon barrels, you know. They were really lying all over the place. And the painted whatever number, K1 or K2 or B3, which meant something to somebody, you know. And there's not enough stay by them, like. But you have a sense of direction, I suppose, as well, you know.
Was it any worse at night time where you didn't have stars or whatever, you know, light?
For travelling, you mean? Why, except for on the road down, like, which didn't matter for a mile or two each side, like, it was no problem, like, you know. I mean, the only time we moved at night was, like, when it was down these patrols to harass them. You know, they'll get no John and I, but we're only talking about a mile or somewhat like, with nothing, a mile and a half, you know, and just lying in wait. But when we had to leave Gazala and coming down, there was mostly day and night travel there, like.
Did you move around much during the day within the box? Did you move a great deal? Or were you kind of still camouflaged?
Well, you camouflage everything as much as you can. That was, again, aircraft-like, you know. But you weren't within spotting distance of him. But he was moving up what he used to do. When he went round and he was breaking through the 150 Brigade, his tanks were trying to range on. There was a lot of guesswork, you know. You get one of these six-pounder anti-personnel, you know. He'd bang, 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 and he'd get a few of them off. Then maybe out for 2 or 3 hours, you know. See, but in the box, we had no heavy artillery and out of that at all. There was a certain amount of strafing, but it was not to write home about from his air force. But he was more concerned, the bulk of his force was breaking through the Free French and 0151 were getting into Tobruk, you see. And when he did that, of course, we were surrounded. So they wondered what was going to happen there. So the divisional commander had an idea, do what he did, break through his skeleton, Ryan, and get around the outside of him again, which we did. And the 69 Brigade did, but our 9th Battalion and the South Africans went down the coast. South Africans went into Tobruk and they were picked up, but the 9th Battalion broke through, kept going and rejoined us later.
What were your feelings when you realised in effect you were surrounded?
Well, we thought it was ridiculous. We blamed the Army Commander. We couldn't. I mean, even at that moment of time, whether it worked or not, I mean, I'm not a supreme strategist, but we thought at the time Rommel's involved down there, he's got his main forces down there, he's got to have his supplies, hasn't he? As a division, I mean, to all intents and purposes, it didn't work that way, we're going to be writ off. So we had enough grub, ammunition to last for Christ, maybe a week, fortnight, I don't know. Why didn't we go forward? Could his line of communications properly fight to the bloody death? He had mouth up that way and that could have done much damage. All he could have done is stop him getting back over. And if he wasn't getting his petrol and his this, that and the other, he would have been in trouble. I mean, it's easy to talk here from that point of view, but I think it was panic stations from General Ritchie's point of view. Lost his tanks, lost this, lost that. A lot of stupidity to my point of view, mind.
Within the battalion itself, what were the men's feelings? other than being angry with the army commander.
Well, I wish you ever going to be in a bloody buggy if an out, you know. The morale wasn't there, said, oh, we beat an out of that, you know. The idea was we should have a go, you know. When he's breaking through the 1-5-0 brigade, we thought we should have bust out our box, went and hit him on the flank and really had a, let's have a showdown. We'd have fought him to death, he would have been beat, because his supplies would have run out. It was life and death for him, and Richie let him get away with it. To me, that, and to what the thoughts of the blokes at the time, Christ.
When you were told you were going to go out west, what were your thoughts then, of actually going through?
Well, we thought it was bloody chaos, this. It's what we're going to do. And then, for one of the few times I explained things to you, well, we're going forward, we're going to bust a hole through his line, and gun around the outside of him again, around what they call the many tracks, pull him right round, and we're going to come out on the front of your wire at Fort Maddalena, which is just a name, not a Hebrew rule, like Fort Maddalena, and that sort of happened. But, I mean, you had to discard everything that you could do without. You wanted water, ammunition, and your weapons. So there was bloody loads of you had to leave everything else, you know. And we organised.
What did you do with the stuff you were leaving?
Just dumped it in the trenches where I left it, hoping someday I'd come back and, you know. But
Can you describe to me how you personally were involved and what was happening when you pushed out at that night?
Yeah, it's Major Clark we had. He was adjutant then, like, you know. He had charge of the operation, see. He took B Company out there, and beyond our outpost, you know what it had been, near enough to the German lines, and German-Italian lines, like. And at a given hour, at dark, they were moving in, you know, and that to put a hole, gun throw, put a hole through them, like this, that and the other. That to hold the flanks, and then the rest of the brigade had to pour through. It was great on paper, like, you know what I mean? But that's basically what happened, like. But there's wagons running into slit trenches, and the German strong points, the Italians lost the battle, but the German strong points was having a go, you know, this, that, and the other. But there were, it was like going to a British football match. I mean, it started off, you know, but after that, one was catching up the other, you know. And anyway, they were taming through and all, gunning. It was surprising when he did get through and get back the front of your way, you know. There were quite a few vehicles lost, but not on the scale. If we'd stopped there, we'd have lost the whole division, you see. And anyway, the 9th Battalion commander, he was a bit apprehensive about it. So he decided to come down, make a bolt down with the South Africans down the Coast Road. They'd run into a bit of trouble, but they fought their way out of it, you know.
What are your memories, your own personal memories of that night?
Well, personal memories that night, when we were going through, Big Company made the hole, like, and there was people running around all over the bloody place, the Italians trying to get themselves up, and there was this, that and the other. The Germans was firing anti-tank stuff, machine gun fire, and one or two trucks getting picked up, you know. We just got over this ridge, and I thought we stayed going from here on. And he opened up, he knocked the front wheels off our truck, you see. Everybody bailed over the bloody side. They were running all over the place. And diving into dugouts, full of Italians, you know. They were sitting there, I don't know what they were waiting for, opening time, I think. And some of them were just throwing grenades in, some of them were just leaving them and such as that, you know. And the German strong point, on the right leg, and he was sending anti-tank shots like infantry fire and sat in the other. So we went round on the flank and we put him out of action, like, you know. I went in with Bren guns and a couple of grenades and followed him with the Brens and put him out of action. But right along the front was lit up like night time. The other column was going through away, the Grey Nowards in East York. They had the same problem, the odd truck on fire, it was lighting the night up, you know. But the other trucks was following on, like, if there was a strong point there or somebody was having a go, all the wagon driver did, he charged that and run the buggers over. If the wagon got stuck, everybody jumped off and got another wagon. You know, it was organised without being organised, you know what I mean? And now we hit a minefield that we'd laid, you know. We'd laid it 2 or 3 weeks previously. And had to scrap down now, get pretty bare, look for mines, you know. It wasn't a very wide one, like, get the trucks through. A bit farther up there, there was all little columns, you know, trying to get through on their own, like, you weren't matched. And farther up, there was, they did the same problem. There was nobody willing to get down and scrap their mines out, you know. So, one of the drivers, he'd volunteered for to charge through with a wagon. He went through, never hit a mine. So everybody else were following his try marks, you know. We got them out. The lads, aye.
Do you remember his name?
Offhand, I cannot. He was in a transport. Was it? It could come back to us, like, but at the time, man, there were so many things going off.
So you found another lorry after yours was hit?
Oh, aye. We just scrapped around and two of the blocks our truck had disappeared. They had dashed back over, and they were took us prisoners. I was looking for them, a little tanty town, a lad from over the coast there, and Albert Davison. They had bailed away back, I don't know what for, they finished up as prisoners, like. So there's other trucks where you just dive onto another truck, you know, and kept going, like, and get organised, like, and you should have got your weapons, and such as that. When daylight come, there was a little column, and then we found her on the one. There was about half a dozen trucks, I think, in our column. Kept going, and the block of the first truck must have known what it was going like. The thing was, go straight forward, these many tracks, and then away, you know. And that's sort of what I said. 9 to half a mile or a mile didn't matter. So anyway, daylight was brought, and pedalled along, and there was a jerry working on it with a digger, bulldozer. And he was waving to us, he must have thought we were Italians, you know. What, he was building some kind of dumper, didn't he? He was working away, he was all on his own and all. Because some clever boy out from shot him off his bloody bulldozer. Said, what a dirty trick. And we got a bit farther, what's this? There's half a dozen German armoured cars coming. Hightailing this way, because our driver's his left hand down, giving it this, you know. And the lads was firing, like, one of them stopped and must hit his tyres, you know, sort of that. Because he couldn't down out what his shelter structure were, Bren gunfire. And the others give the chase up, they weren't as fast as us. And then he kept making other columns and catching up, you know, and there was bloke town anti-tank ones, the town this, there was... surprising how much stuff they got back to the front here.
Did you come across trucks that had broken down with people on it?
There was no people on them. Somebody picked them up. We found broken down trucks, but somebody else had picked them up, you know. We didn't have that picking them up. Right.
Who was in your truck?
What was left out of our platoon, probably about... was Frankie Trotter. He was platoon sergeant. He wasn't good, very good, Frankie, like. And a few odds and ends, you know, what we picked up. A couple of signals, I think. Couple of blokes out the rifle corps. You didn't take a name, like, you know, you were all on there, like. And there was one officer in the front sitting with a driver. What the hell they call him? He was only second lieutenant. He didn't matter. You were all one then. But when we finally late afternoon, well, late, not probably daylight, like, got to Fort Madalena, there was a lot in before us, mine, there was still strong. Spike Jennings was there, he was organising things, my Spike guy. I give him his Joe, like, he was getting well organised. Wasn't long getting him into shape again, you know.
Had your journey taken several days and nights to get round to the fort? From breaking out to getting to the fort, was it several days and nights? Travelling?
To getting into Tobruk, you mean?
No, to Madalena.
For us? Oh no, we left Gazala the night before, you see, and crawling and boxing your way through his defensive position, round that, and it was sometime after tea the next day, we got to Madalena. Oh, it wasn't days, no, we did, you know, one stretch. Didn't know that far, 300 miles, I didn't know, 200 miles, something like that. But,
what was the morale of the battalion like after this?
Well, they didn't care. They seemed they were disappointed, like there would have been that they leave so many gay and had casualties where we could have would had casualties the other way, but they would have preferred to do it the hard way, like, you know, and do some damage to the Rommel's lot. But was trying to knock them into shape. We left Madeleine and went farther down the front of your Y, and they were starting squaring up and one bloody thing or another. And then the next year come to Brookwood Farland. They was expecting it all, you know. And we maybe reform and do a counterattack to Brookwood Farland. He's on our tails. So to move down to Mersey Matrue. So that had been the base for the Western Desert, supplies and everything, you know. Where Mersey Matrue, it's only a few buildings now, not a nice little harbour there. It's a small place, like, and a few buildings, and right down again the coast, nice spot. But right away for miles right round, it went right up 3 or 4 miles, the escarpment right round, you know. Then there was the open desert after that. Where there were pretty good defensive positions, like. So that to hold the escarpment, they knew he was coming, they knew we couldn't stop him. That to hold the escarpment, our orders were for 3 days, 3 nights, and come out on the own steam on the third night and make to a place called Alamein. We'd never heard of Alamein then, you know. It was just the name to us. We didn't know then they were putting minefields out and laying this defensive line with troops from Syria and Palestine and that. They didn't tell us that. But anyway, his nearest approach to Mersey Matrue, he's coming in, they stuck us there. But all the mines were cold, laid a pretty good mine, failed out, everything was laid out. Just got it finished and they pulled us out, they put the Indians in there, and we had to, a few miles farther south, we were on the escarpment. There was plenty of good cover mines, they said, lay a mine, failed, we had no mines to lay. We laid them. But that's where we changed waddies a couple of times. And the first morning in this wadi, and I think it was the second day, he'd come down, he was bypassing the columns, and he dropped off about, no more than a mile out. So the columns all nice and tidy. The lads all got out, lined up, you know, got on parade, and come marching towards the escarpment, you know. We were a bit thin on the ground there, and different. And I was operating the Bren gun light. I was a good shot, and that two Cree buggers with me was a lad from Hull. He's been a good second-rate fighter, you know, and Geordie Lake, right? And from Birtley, Big N Whiteford. Two good scrappers, two kind of lads, always fighting among themselves, you know. And she says, "What's this lot?" He says, "I'll go to the match." Should have gone pretty much when they get another 200 or 300 yards. They must have got about 600-700 yards. Besides, give a nice little burst. First time, one of them was, you know, a bit hesitant, but they're coming forward. But we didn't know. I mean, this escarpment was very rough. There must have been an artillery OP up there, and there's 2 or 3 guns back here somewhere. He must have spotted them. All of a sudden, the 25 pounders. They weren't firing at them, they were firing at his trucks. First time, the bloody trucks had gone out. That was great. But these buggers, you know, they come this way, and they were having canny few casualties, and we couldn't miss. And then, anyway, the boat turned, and it wasn't exactly an early retreat. They were scampering, you know, all the way back. Well, the rest of the trucks hadn't been hit. They left them, they pulled away out, tried to get out of range of the artillery, you know. So then, folks had to keep running. That sort of little thing was happening all down in the front, I should imagine. Then they pulled us out of there, for no apparent reason. We went maybe about half a mile more down. Another wadi, another same position. And on the top, there must have been 300 or 400 ton of bloody rocks. I don't know how piled down, whether the Italians had done it or what. And there was a road in, it was like a position, you know. There was no inside. When you got in there, a direct hit from anything wouldn't have disturbed you, you know. It would have took a bomb, like. So a brand new position in there, you could see the whole area, aye. And I joined C Company, and they'd lost Sergeant Major, all them had lost them coming out of Gazala. We only had 2 officers, and one of them had a little wound on his hand, and they weren't very happy. They were down the wadi, and Joe Ranson was colour sergeant. He got killed at the Marath Line. He was Sergeant Major then. Joe Ranson from Hutley Spring was colour sergeant, and he was organising. And the only other brilliant show was me, who had maybe about 30, 40 privates, you know. Not canny lads, just distribute them out the best you could. But Joe was then organising, and Anyway, the 9th Battalion was out in the open plain. Not, you know, I'm talking about bloody a mile or somewhat away. And that we watched Rommel's main column coming down. That's when Wakenshaw got the VC. Couldn't see it, but you could see the all hell breaking loose, knocking shit out of each other. And we did out to storm over and we give it a bust like and all that. And then I watched one little incident, binoculars. Forget where I picked them up. Way down to our left somewhere, the 6th Battalion was down there, but I think they had been broken up a bit, and there was a big wadi run right away down there, that opened from the top, and there was a 2-pound anti-tank gun, one of ours, was mounted on a portee in there. He was high-tailing for his life, there was a Mark IV chasing him, like, where he could, Mark IV could knock him out at 1,000 yards, but he had to be within 3 foot, you know. So I was watching, this was great. Way down the wadi, these blokes and stopped, must have been looking back, way down. Looking back, I said, something's going to happen here. And then they found a little chute up here, through shut. They went in there, you know. Bolt turned, and you could see the figures were going through them loading, you know. And I was watching this bloody tank come down. This Mark IV.